Hey friends, before we start this week's episode, we wanted to give you another announcement about things coming up in the future. Today's episode is in honor of the 17 kids and teachers at the Parkland shooting that happened at Marjory Stoneman Douglas. Today we're doing two women from Florida in their honor. But we wanted to remind you about a couple dates coming up. Those dates are
March 14th, Women's March Action, March 24th, March for Our Lives, and April 20th, National School Walkout. We want to make sure that we're supporting each one of those efforts.
That first one is organized by the same people who did the Women's March.
Yes.
The second one is organized by the students themselves.
Amazing.
We'll see you there.
Yeah, we will.
Hi, everybody.
Hello, everyone.
And welcome to The Bitchery of History. My name is Max.
And I'm Kim.
And this week, I'm going to be talking to you about Marjory Stoneman Douglas.
Ooh. Yes. And I'll be talking about Ruth Bryan Owens.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, but first of all, you're not Allison.
Max, how did you know?
Welcome, Kim. Tell everyone who you are.
Thanks, Max. Well, if you have listened to Bitch With Me at all, you probably recognize my voice, but I'm a producer for The Bitchery of History, and I also...
For about a year and a half.
About a year and a half. Yeah, mm-hmm. I can't believe it's been that long.
I can't either. It's wild.
It's an amazing ride. But then I also am on Bitch With Me with Max, which is... where you've heard me.
And Jeanette from last
week. And Jeanette
week.
As well. Yeah, oh, absolutely. Gosh. Your episode with Jeanette last week was so great.
Yeah. I mean, it was a lot of fun.
I mean, you know, there's a reason I'm with you guys on Bitch With Me. I can listen to you both talk all day long, especially about amazing women from history.
Yes, ma'am. Well, this week, like we said in the cold open, is an honor episode. We're doing two women from Florida. Of course, Marjory Stoneman Douglas is the namesake of the school where the shooting happened. And Ruth Bryan Owen is also a Florida person. And you know what? You're going first this week. So why don't you tell us who she is?
Yeah, I am actually. I'm going to tell you a little bit about her, Max, because I'm kind of surprised that I had never heard of Ruth Bryan Owens before, because she's a pretty significant figure in not just Florida's history, but our nation's history.
And I should say, I'm from Florida. I grew up in Miami. I had no idea who she was either.
And that's, I mean, totally fair. She was actually originally from Jacksonville, Illinois. So her full name, prepare yourself for this one, is actually Ruth Baird Bryan Leavitt Owen Road.
Leave it
at the door where you came in, you know. No, she was actually married several times, which is where she acquired a lot of those names later on. But she was born October 2nd, 1885 in Jacksonville, Illinois. And she was the oldest child of, brace yourself for it, William Jennings Bryan.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Famed orator, three-time Democratic presidential candidate.
Yeah.
Lost all three times. You know, there's a reason he's not a president. Mm-hmm. But he was also the press secretary for Woodrow Wilson. So very notable in his own right. Mm-hmm. And then her mother was Mary Baird Bryan, who was actually a very well-respected attorney. And Ruth learned public speaking and politics from her father. She kind of grew up in that whole sphere, but she was deeply impressed by her mother and even once said, quote, "I would like to emulate her. She's a thoroughly feminine woman with the mind of a thoroughly masculine man," end quote, which I find kind of fun.
I like,
you know,
it.
For that sort of time period, I think that an independent woman who is strong thinking would seem somewhat masculine.
Absolutely.
For their traditional definitions.
Hell, we're
of
still
those.
Fighting that today.
Right? Mm-hmm. But still a great sentiment and amazing that her mother had already kind of taken that on. The family moved quite a bit when she was young due to William's political career.
Sure.
Obviously, you know, three presidential runs will do that to a family.
Right.
And Ruth doted on her father. She actually even sat with him pretty often on the congressional floor when he was engaged in debates. And actually during the ferocious tariff debates of the 1890s. Some saucy stuff there. But Ruth's frequent appearances led members of the House to name her the sweetheart of the House.
Oh,
which is kind of great, right? Mm-hmm. Right? So she attended D.C. public schools and Monticello Female Academy in Godfrey, Illinois, before she enrolled in the University of Nebraska in 1901. And she attended classes for 2 years there until she met the man who would be her first husband, who was an artist named William Homer Leavitt. Okay. So that's where that part of her name comes from. She actually met him because he painted her father's portrait.
Oh, okay.
Which was kind of an interesting way to meet your future husband. The couple...
There are worse ways.
Right? There are. The couple had two children together, Ruth and John, but they weren't really in a super happy marriage. So they were only married for about 5 years. They divorced in 1909. And in the year previous, Ruth had actually served as her father's traveling secretary during his third and final presidential campaign. Okay. So there was just kind of some tensions there. She was out of the house pretty frequently, and she was kind of starting to develop some political aspirations herself.
Sure.
So after the divorce, she went to Germany to study voice, actually, which is kind of a little bit of a departure from politics.
Sure, bit of a left turn.
Right? But that's actually where she met her second husband, Reginald Altham Owen, who was a British officer in the Royal Engineers.
Okay.
So they got married in 1910, and actually after 3 years of him being stationed in Jamaica, they returned to England, where Ruth gave birth to her third child and her first with her second husband. Mm-hmm. That was a lot of numbers there. I hope you were able to follow all of
the
those.
The third child with the second husband.
Exactly. Yes. So during World War One, while Reginald was campaigning in Palestine and Gallipoli, she actually worked for 15 months with Lou Henry Hoover in London as Secretary Treasurer of the American Woman's War Relief Fund. So she's getting into some pretty heavy stuff, you know? She also studied nursing, and actually in 1915, she served as a voluntary nurse in the Egypt-Palestine conflict.
Wow.
Girl got around. I'm not kidding. When I'm telling
she's
you...
She's like bopping around the globe.
She's got a pretty storied and wide range of things that she did. And I'm only getting started here.
Yeah, I see. I see.
There's quite a bit. So not too long into this conflict, her husband unfortunately contracted a degenerative kidney disease.
Oh.
Really was devastating for the family. So they picked everybody up and moved back to the States, actually to Florida, where Ruth's parents were residing at the time. And she gave birth to their second child while living there. She was a leader there in the PTA, the Theater Guild, the National Consumers League, and she actually served as president of the Miami Women's Club.
Hey-o.
Right? And she spoke on the national tour circuit with them, sort of her first foray into those and into public speaking, which became a big part of her career later on as well. So because Major Owen's disease really left him unable to work, that left the whole burden for supporting the family on Ruth. She was solely responsible for their income. So she began lecturing on the, I might mess up this pronunciation a little bit, but Chautauqua and Lyceum circuits, which was an adult education movement. It was sort of like a tent convention where people would go around speaking, and it's something that kind of continues today. She quickly became the highest paid woman on the entire circuit and was really able to support her family.
Good for her.
Right? Not only that, in addition to supporting her family and maintaining their livelihood, with the money from her earnings, she also became a female pioneer in the burgeoning film industry.
What?
Right? Okay, like back the train up.
Right.
So she's been a nurse, she's a public speaker, and now suddenly she's a director.
She's a filmmaker.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, of
a
course.
A woman after my own heart.
Right,
I
mine
love
too.
Her.
Uh-huh. I can't believe that I'd never heard of her.
Right. And you know, I should also say while we're paused for a second that we seem to be, the last couple weeks, finding women who the burden of their family fell to them.
Fell to them, yes. Yeah. And so, you know, in times of trial, you really see what people are made of. And it
Absolutely.
Kind of forces them into these situations where they realize their true potential. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating what people are able to come up with.
The crucible.
Exactly. So... she became a director, producer, and screenwriter for a feature film in 1922 called Once Upon a Time, or Scheherazade.
Okay.
Right? Even though she saw herself as a film pioneer, which she really, truly was, her other pursuits wound up taking precedence, and she returned to the political sphere after completing the film.
What year did she make that film?
That was in 1922.
Paramount Pictures was established 1923.
Yes, it was.
As a point of reference.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, and Warner
which
Brothers
is the
as well.
Oldest working studio in Hollywood.
Correct.
Yes.
It's pretty incredible.
Right. Correction. Warner Brothers was founded in 23. Paramount was like 1819, something like that.
Right. Exactly. Paramount's way older. But it was pretty amazing. And she even scored a distribution deal for this as well. She went out, even though she financed the whole thing, she still managed to go out and network enough that she scored a distribution deal. It's incredible.
It is.
Anybody who works in the film industry knows how hard that is. Of course. So she's returning to the political sphere now. So a year after her father's death in 1925, Ruth decided to run for the House of Representatives in a district in Florida's Atlantic Coast. So this was a state that also refused to ratify the 19th Amendment initially, which is what which is what allowed women the right to vote. So in 1925, she narrowly lost that first Democratic primary to six-term incumbent William J. Sears by 779 votes.
Whoa.
An incredibly narrow margin for her first time out in a major election. She didn't give up, though. Even though her husband died in 1927, so 2 years later, she'd been working as an administrator during that time for the University of Miami, and she'd played a significant role when a hurricane hit Miami in 1927, so she had kind of started to become a more well-known figure. And with the encouragement and help of her mother, she actually ran for Congress again in 1928. She adopted the same high-energy campaigning tactics that her father had been really famous for. So spirited oratory, and that was kind of what had distinguished her father apart. She was determined to reach as many citizens as possible in the district, which was then one of the largest geographic districts in the country, which stretched more than 500 miles along the Atlantic seaboard from Jacksonville to Key West.
Wow.
Right? She cruised the coastline in a green Ford coupe.
The congressional district went from Jacksonville to the Keys?
Key West. Yes. And she...
That's all of Florida.
It's all of Florida. And she drove the length of this in a green Ford coupe dubbed the Spirit of Florida. She logged more than 10,000 miles to give 500 stump speeches. She won the Democratic primary and then swamped her Republican opponent by 30,000 votes in the general election, becoming the first congresswoman from the South. Upon her victory, she referred humorously to her father's unsuccessful bids for president. Quote, there, I am the first Brian who ran for anything and got it. I just find it hilarious. So she began her term of office on March 4th, 1929, while a widow and mother of four. Can you fathom that? She's by herself.
No.
Has just been elected the first congresswoman of the United States. And she's a widow. And
it
a
astounds
of
me.
It's incredible.
It just never ceases to amaze me.
Right?
I think we've said this multiple times before. Like when people say, people ask me all the time, when are you going to stop covering women on this podcast?
Yeah.
Never. I'm going to be doing this podcast when I'm 65,000 years old.
Yes. It's incredible. Her election was actually contested after she won. On the grounds that she lost her citizenship by marrying an alien when she had married her husband, who was a British. So by the Cable Act in 1922, she could petition for her citizenship, which she did in 1925, which was less than the 7 years required by the Constitution at that point. She argued her case before the House Committee of Elections, saying that no American had ever lost his citizenship by marriage. She said that she lost her citizenship because she was a woman, not because of her marital status.
Mm.
And the House of Representatives voted in her favor.
Yeah.
Because of course they did. Because
good.
It wasn't right.
Exactly.
Now, she served her first 2-year term, then ran unopposed again in 1930. Though this was her last 2-year term, she lost the 1932 election to a Democratic candidate, J. Mark Wilcox, who supported the repeal of prohibition because she was a dry candidate. She supported prohibition.
Okay.
However, we're going to kind of gloss over some of the things that she did accomplish during her term as a congressman because she did so much with her career and her time in Congress that it's kind of almost too numerous to miss, to list.
Absolutely.
It was just amazing. But like I said, she did lose the 1932 election because she was in support of prohibition. However, that was not the end of her political career. In 1933, President Franklin Roosevelt actually appointed her to be envoy extraordinaire and minister plenipotentiary to Denmark, making her the first American woman to hold a major diplomatic post.
Wow.
3 years later, she married Captain Borg Rode of the Danish Royal Guards, which automatically made her a Danish citizen now. Right?
Borg.
Borg. So... now, unfortunately, that meant that she had to give up her diplomatic capacity because she possessed a dual citizenship.
Right.
So she resigned, and with her husband and family, she returned to live in the States. But she continued to lecture and write, and in 1939 became a visiting professor at Monticello College. In 1945, Roosevelt named her special assistant to the State Department to aid the drafting of the United Nations Charter. And in 1949, President Harry Truman appointed her alternate delegate to the United Nations General Assembly. Wow. In 1954, she traveled back to Denmark to accept the Order of Merit from King Frederick for her contributions to the Danish-American friendship. But while in Copenhagen on July 26th, she passed away from a heart attack, and she was actually cremated and buried there. Oh. And then in 1922, she was inducted into the Florida Women's Hall of Fame.
Wow.
Quite a storied career for somebody who I'd never heard of before.
What a story.
Right?
Thank you so much for sharing that.
You're so welcome.
If she was the congressperson for all up and down the Florida coast,
yes.
The east side of the Florida coast, that's where I grew up.
Yes.
She would have been my congresswoman.
She would have been your congresswoman if you were alive. In the early 1900s.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, wow. All right.
Thank goodness. Yes.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, no, thank you for listening, Max. Now, I'm super excited to hear a little bit about Marjorie Stoneman Douglas.
Marjorie Stoneman Douglas.
Yes.
First of all, let's talk about how cool a name Stoneman is.
I don't think you can get much cooler.
Stoneman. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, this name is everywhere right now.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely everywhere. And I'll tell you that researching her story in particular was actually pretty difficult because of all of the stuff that's happening right now.
Because the search results bring up, of course.
Nothing but, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, she was born Marjorie Stoneman,
okay.
April 7th, 1890, so around the same time as Ruth, in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Oh, wow.
And she was the only child, actually, of her parents, Frank Bryant Stoneman and Lillian Trefethen.
Okay.
And Lillian Trefethen, who was actually a concert violinist.
Oh, wow.
Now, she had quite a rocky childhood, I will say. Her parents actually separated it when she was 6 years old.
And
they didn't really have a very good relationship before or after. And in fact, when they got divorced, her mother picked her up and moved her back to the family house. She was living in a house, in this family house in Massachusetts, with her mom, her aunt, and her grandparents, who didn't get along amongst themselves. And who were also constantly speaking ill of her father, which she really didn't appreciate.
No, of course not. He's still her dad.
Exactly. And plus, on top of all this, her mother was also going through some mental issues as well. And in fact, throughout Marjorie's life, she ends up having to care for her mother as her mental health slowly kind of declines and deteriorates over her life. And in fact, Marjorie also has some mental issues as well, because she attributes it to the rough childhood that she had. And the majority of the quote mental things that she went through were actually nervous breakdowns.
Sure.
That happened.
There's post-traumatic stress that comes in there. They didn't call it at the time, but there's a lot that comes along with having to essentially then be the parent in your relationship with your parent.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But despite this, she thrived. I mean, at the age of 16, she begins to write early on.
Okay.
And at the age of 16, she contributes to the most popular children's publication of the day.
What?
St. Nicholas Magazine.
What?
Where have we heard this before? Two episodes ago with Rachel Carson.
My gosh.
Reminder, this is also where William Faulkner and F. Scott Fitzgerald were first published as The piece was called Double Beheadings and Double Curtailings. It was actually a puzzle that was published. And then in 1907, she was awarded a prize by the Boston Herald for a piece called An Early Morning Paddle, which was a story about a boy who watches a sunrise from a canoe.
Wow.
Eventually, she leaves her college in 1908. This is the year after she wins this award.
Okay.
And she goes to Wellesley College.
Wellesley.
Which is where Hillary Clinton went.
Yes.
And Madeleine Albright. And Nora Roberts and Diane Sawyer and Annie Jump Cannon from season one.
My gosh.
So, you know, she's in really bad company.
Right.
She graduated with a BA in English in 1912, joined elocution classes. She joined the first suffrage club at the school, which had only six other members at the time.
Wow.
She was elected to be the class orator. I don't know what that means, but she was elected to be the class orator. And she had to turn it down because she was so busy, she couldn't do it.
Oh my gosh. Girl had too many things on her plate.
So she goes through school, and then during her senior year, right before graduation, she visits home and her mother reveals a lump on her chest.
Oh, wow.
Marjorie herself, pretty much. Her family, like, is hands off. We already know they're not the best.
Right.
And so Marjorie has to arrange the surgery to have the lump removed from her mother's breast. And then after her graduation ceremony later that year, her aunt actually informed her that the lump had metastasized.
Oh, my gosh.
And within a couple months, her mother passed away.
Oh, wow.
The family left all the funeral arrangements to Marjorie. All of them.
Oh, my word.
So after this, she kind of drifts for a while.
Yeah,
and in fact, she ends up marrying a man named Kenneth Douglas in 1914 at the age of 24, which is where we get Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. And this man sells himself as being he's like in his 30s, and he sells himself as being like this newspaper editor who's like up and coming. And it turns out to be a complete con. She gets taken for a ride, essentially.
Wow.
And we don't really know exactly the extent or to the degree of the con, because Marjorie never really talked about it.
Right.
Which is weird for her, because as we'll get into, she was never quiet about anything.
Right.
Ever.
Right.
And this is the one thing that she really did not talk to people about.
Interesting.
We'd have a couple. We do know that he went to jail for 6 months for passing a bad check.
Okay.
He may have been married to another woman when he married her. And it was actually the last thing, the straw that broke the camel's back, was he tried to scam her father.
Nope.
Who was not living in the same place at the time. He was living in Miami at the time.
Wow.
And it got the attention of her uncle, Frank Stoneman.
Okay.
Who said, why don't you come to Miami and end your marriage?
Yeah.
And we'll get you a job over here. Because her father had bought a paper and became the first publisher of what would later become the Miami Herald.
What?
Which is the paper of Florida.
My gosh. Yeah, yes.
Exactly.
My word.
Exactly. So she leaves.
Uh-huh.
She goes to Miami. She sees her father for the first time in 9 years.
9 years.
And she begins a writing career.
Yeah.
The writing career begins a society column, essentially, writing about tea parties and society events.
Mm-hmm.
And news was actually so slow that later she admitted to making up some of her stories. She said, quote, somebody would say, who's that Mrs. T.Y. wash rag you've got in your column? And I would say, oh, you know, I don't think she's been here that long.
It's totally fair. You got the room to play and not really much news to print.
Exactly.
She's already a gifted storyteller.
I mean, when she moved to Miami, there were less than 5,000 people living there.
Oh my gosh.
And almost every member of the police force was a member of the KKK.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Wow. Solid place to live and work.
Quick side note. Her father, Frank Stoneman, had actually been elected to be a circuit judge in Florida at the time. But the governor of Florida, Napoleon Bonaparte Broward.
What?
What a name.
What a name.
Refused to certify the vote because her father had fiercely advocated against him on his trying to drain the Everglades. He was a builder, a developer.
Yeah.
And her father really was a cog in the wrench for him.
Right.
A wrench in the cogs. Around 1916, so this is what, 19... So this is a year later. So around 1916, about a year later, she's assigned to write a story about the first woman from Miami to join the U.S. Naval Reserve.
Wow.
However, the woman never showed up for the interview.
What?
So Douglas joined the Navy instead.
What? I'm sorry.
Talk about a left turn, right?
That was not where I was expecting that to go at all. I thought you were so she was going to go find her. No. She just joins the Navy herself.
She just went, okay, if she's not going to show up, why don't I do it? So she joined.
That's a lengthy process,
as
though.
A yeoman first class.
She
didn't like it.
Okay,
she didn't like getting up early.
I mean, also fair.
And
she
kept correcting her superior's grammar.
Oh.
Which they didn't like.
No.
So she eventually asked for a discharge.
Okay.
Instead, she joined the American Red Cross. She got an honorable discharge.
Okay, good.
And she was in Paris when the armistice ending World War I was signed. And she stayed in Paris afterwards and cared for war refugees. And she said later that seeing them displaced and in a state of shock helped her understand the plight of refugees in Miami many, many years later.
Right.
So after that, she comes back to Miami and becomes an editor for the Miami Herald again.
she
just
does.
Took a quick break. She was
I feel both of our ladies just took these detours from their main careers that were just what?
Right, exactly.
Out of left field.
It's I feel like being a soldier now.
Yeah. okay. See, I'm going to be a nurse for a deuces. Couple of years.
Exactly. So she comes back. She becomes an assistant editor for the Miami Herald. She writes an article called The Galley, which actually becomes like a daily column.
Wow.
And she becomes something of a local celebrity in Miami.
Wow.
She wrote about, really, she wrote about whatever she wanted. Yeah. I mean, her father owned the newspaper. So she wrote about women's suffrage, that's civil amazing. Rights. She wrote about sanitation, like a better sanitation.
Wow.
And she also opposed prohibition. And she also railed against foreign trade tariffs as well.
So
our two ladies have a lot in common.
They have a lot in common, I was going to say. Wow, this is kind of amazing.
In the 1920s, and all of this is before she writes the seminal work, right? In the 1920s, she writes something that she later calls the single most important thing she ever accomplished as a result of something she written. And she actually wrote a piece called Martin Talbert of North Dakota is Walking Florida Now. And it was a ballad. It was actually a song lamenting the death of a 22-year-old vagrant who was beaten to death in a labor camp.
Wow.
It was printed in the Herald, read aloud during a session of the Florida legislature, which then passed a law banning convict leasing. In large part due to her writing.
That's incredible.
After that, she decided to quit the newspaper in 1923.
Yeah.
She becomes a freelance writer. She writes ad copy for people coming to Miami because she says, you know, one of the best things about Florida is that it's not developed. So let's get people here to develop it.
Absolutely.
She writes fiction articles and short stories. She writes plays. She ends up writing over 109 fiction articles and stories.
Wow.
40 of them published in the Saturday Evening Post. So then I'm going to kind of skip to the 1940s because, again, 109 articles that I could, and short stories and stuff that I could talk about. So in the early 1940s, she gets approached by a publisher who makes this book series called Rivers of America. And he wants her to write a book about the Miami River, which she didn't find very interesting. In fact, she calls it, quote, about an inch long. And she says, there's not enough to write about. Could I write it about the Everglades instead? Yeah. And he said, yeah, sure. Go ahead.
All right.
And so she takes 5 years to try and research the Everglades. And the reason it takes her so long is because there was no research at the time about the Everglades. 1947, when the book is finally published, which is exactly the same year that the Everglades National Park is established, the park only covers 20% of what the Everglades originally was.
Wow.
Before this, and she'd actually gotten started in protecting the Everglades earlier in the 1920s.
Right.
By joining she joined the committee that was set up to figure out where the boundaries of the Everglades National Park were going to be. She joins it because most of the developers in Florida saw the Everglades as a swamp.
Right.
Which it is.
Right.
But at the same time, what she finds in her writing and why the River of Grass is such an important piece of work is because she realized that the Everglades is responsible for almost 80% of the drinking water in South Florida.
Wow.
80% of the drinking water.
What?
Lake Okeechobee, which is, if you look at a map of Florida, there's that that dot in the middle. That's Lake Okeechobee.
Right.
It provides, it's a freshwater body of water, and it provides almost all of the drinking water for all of Florida.
Wow.
And it provides basically all of the water for Miami.
Yeah.
And she figured out that the Lake Okeechobee is fed by the Biscayne Aquifer, which is the underground water.
Right.
Which is fed by the Everglades.
Oh, my word.
And it is literally because of her that the Everglades is a national park. And it's also because of her that right now the Everglades, when it was made a national park, it became one of the first times in the history of the National Protection Act, the act that allows presidents to establish parks
national
like this.
Parks. Yes.
It became one of the first times when a park was designated to protect an environmental area, as opposed to just saying, this is beautiful and we should protect it because it is gorgeous.
Yes.
Instead, the law was used to say, this is absolutely necessary. Exactly.
Right.
We need this to survive.
Right.
Now I want to read a quote because this quote, there are no other Everglades in the world, is the first line of the book. And it's actually when you go to the Everglades National Park website, it is the quote that is at the front at the top. And I want to read it because it is absolutely gorgeous. The first paragraph of the Everglades River of Glass. There are no other Everglades in the world. They are they have always been, one of the unique regions of the earth, remote, never wholly known. Nothing anywhere else is like them. Their vast glittering openness, wider than the enormous visible round of the horizon, the racing free saltness and sweetness of their massive winds under the dazzling blue heights of space. They are unique also in the simplicity, the diversity, the related harmony of the forms of life they enclose. The miracle of the light pours over the green and brown expanse of sawgrass and of water, shining and slow-moving below. The grass and water that is the meaning and the central fact of the Everglades of Florida. It is a river of grass.
That's really beautiful. I'm like a little bit teary-eyed.
And what followed for her was a lifetime of activism advocating for the Glades. And I want to talk about in 1969... they were trying to build an airport in the Everglades, a jet port. And they were putting three runways in along with the terminal.
Okay.
And she was vehemently against it. And in fact, she had gone off. She wrote River of Grass and then kind of went off and did more of her freelance writing work.
Right.
And then when people started encroaching, because, you know, people's memories are short.
Short.
When they started forgetting about why the Everglades are so amazing, they started trying to reclaim parts of the land. They started trying to drain parts of the Everglades again. And so she said, no, you're not going to do it. And she founded a group called Friends of the Everglades in 1969 at the age of 79.
My word.
Which then created a base of support for opposing things in the future.
Right.
They ended up stopping that jetway mid-production.
What?
They actually finished a runway. And they got it stopped after it had already been approved.
My gosh.
Okay, one more, because I just can't.
Yep, no, one more. You got to give
it to me. They ended up building some houses and businesses in a part of the Everglades, which was swamp at one point.
Right.
Because again, the Everglades is swamp.
Right.
And when it flooded, residents of this area and the business owners went to Dade County to one of the various committees and said, hey, we really want you to drain this.
Yeah.
And she was the only person who showed up that day to say,
no, you
really shouldn't.
Yeah.
You really shouldn't. And they booed at her. They jeered at her. They shouted at her the entire time.
What?
And she turned to them and said, can't you boo any louder than that?
My God.
She also said, look, I'm an old lady. I've been here since 8 o'clock. It's now 11. I've got all night and I'm used to the heat.
You could literally write a book of these quotes. Like, I just want a book of her.
Oh, I think I've been texting you guys.
Yes, you have. And I've been eating them up because honestly, they make my whole life.
Quote, people can't be rude to me, this poor little old woman, but I can be rude to them, poor darlings, and nobody can stop me.
It's my favorite. It's so good.
I'll tell you, the whole thing is an enormous battle between man's intelligence and his stupidity. And I'm not at all sure that stupidity isn't going to win out in the long run.
Oh my God, it's so true and so applicable to so many things. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, she's one of my favorites.
She's amazing, clearly.
So after that, she went on and just kept protecting the Everglades.
Yeah.
I mean, she lived to the age of 108.
But I wish that you could see my face right now because my word.
While living in a swamp in
with
the Everglades.
No running water.
None. John Rothschild, who helped write her autobiography, said her death was the only thing that could, quote, shut her up. And he added, quote, the silence is terrible.
Yeah, that's true.
One final honor for her. On April 22nd, 2015, while giving an Earth Day speech in the Everglades, President Barack Obama announced that her house had been designated as a National Historic Landmark.
Amazing.
To this day, a park ranger lives in that house.
What?
So they can preserve it.
That's incredible. What a legacy.
Marjorie Stoneman Douglas advocated, politicked, cajoled, and coerced people into doing what she wanted them to do in protecting an issue that she believed in until the day she died at the age of 108. If you're wondering why the students of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School are being as vocal and as active and as amazing as they are right now, look at their example.
Yes. Look at the foundation that she set for them.
Exactly.
Look at the legacy that they have to stand on. You know, we always say that we are only able to reach as high as we are because we stand on the shoulders of those that came before us.
Amen.
Who fought and advocated and who set precedents. And the mm-hmm. only reason that we are able to break through the barriers that we can now reach is because of those people. And that's the thing that I love the most about this podcast, Max, is that we recognize their sacrifice. We recognize their legacy. And then we move forward. We Amen. Teach the next generation. We learn from everything that they did, and we reach higher.
Amen. You know, that's a good segue to the ad break, because afterwards we're going to talk about representation.
Yes, we are. We'll see you in a bit.
Hi, friends. It's Allison here. Well, I'm not here. I'm actually in New Mexico filming my movie, Banging Lainey. And that movie is what gave birth to this podcast years ago. Max and I chatting about it, and I'm so, so excited that he has helped me so far, and you listeners have helped so much in making this movie happen. And that means 2 episodes this month. There's going to be some special guests with Max. And if you are enjoying this podcast, if you want to help more awesome movies happen made by women, supporting learning about women, all you need to do is go to patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. You get access to the contributors blog. I'll probably throw up some behind the scenes photo from our film there as well. Check it out. $1 a podcast, $2 a podcast, $10 a podcast, can do it all at patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. If you're not able to donate financially, I totally understand. I'm working for free for a month in New Mexico. But what you can do is just look down at your phone, your computer, your tablet, your Google Glass, whatever you're listening to this podcast on, and leave us a rating or a review. Those ratings and reviews help other people find the podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. I can't wait to come back and talk to you all in March. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's talk about it, shall we?
Let's talk about it, Max.
Representation and why it matters.
Yes. Now, representation is something that we're hearing a lot about in the current sphere. It's obviously been something that we've talked about for a very long time.
Absolutely.
But I think that the conversation, particularly even in just the last couple of years, has come to the forefront in our cultural conversation, in, you know, even the political conversation. But I kind of want to delve into why representation matters in the entertainment sphere today. We're going to kind of narrow our focus just a little bit.
Yes.
Now, we're recording this the week after the movie Black Panther has come out in theaters.
Amen.
Now, Max, I know you've seen it as well.
Yes.
What did you think about it?
First of all, wow.
Right?
Wow.
I remember when I was a really little girl growing up in Pennsylvania, and of course, every little girl loves to watch Disney movies. Mm-hmm. Now, the majority of Disney princesses are blonde, blue-eyed, and sort of this ideal version of beauty.
Right.
So, of course, me being a brunette, if you've seen my picture, I always really identified with Belle. She was smart and bookish and brunette. And it really mattered to me to see somebody that looked like myself up on screen.
Definitely.
Well, I also grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania in what we called the Back Mountain Bubble, which was largely white, middle class. So I didn't really see a whole lot of other people who didn't look like me growing up. Mm-hmm. Well, now that I'm older, I've gotten to know a lot more of what the world actually looks like. And thinking back on that little girl who saw somebody who looked a little bit more similar to herself on screen and what that meant for me, especially that she was interested in things that I was, books and things like that. What more does that mean to kids growing up in this generation who are now going to see versions of themselves or what's possible for them up on screen?
Exactly. You know, one of the things that I've been loving watching on Twitter and Facebook and all the various social medias is the reaction from kids to Black Panther.
Yeah.
And I mean, talking about Wonder Woman this past summer,
definitely,
seeing their reactions as well. For a kid to see a representation of themselves in something that everyone is talking about makes them think like, one, oh, maybe I'm not the only one who's going through the problems that I'm going through.
Right.
Because, you know, if it's in pop culture, there must be enough people going through it enough people like that.
Right.
For it to be reflected on the screen, or at least in Hollywood, there's people like that for it to be reflected on
screen.
Exactly.
And you even see those you even see the markers of those realizations sometimes happening. Mm-hmm. When we looked at Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games, yes, after those movies came out, there was a huge upswing in girls taking up archery, mm-hmm, which, yeah, is kind was of incredible. So, I mean, it inspires kids. But now looking at, you know, in Black Panther, we have Princess Shuri, who is this incredible tech genius, oh, and also a badass fighter. Mm-hmm. And so I can't wait, honestly, to see the next generation, yeah, of young girls into tech, because they're seeing themselves up on screen and they're seeing, this is a possibility for me. This girl has also done it. She's cool and she can do all of these things. And I think that these, especially
I can be smart and strong.
And strong, yes. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing about this representation, is that we're seeing not just the same characters, yeah, on screen. We're seeing nuanced representations. You know, in this film, all of the characters are incredibly well developed. They all have these amazing storylines, mm-hmm, that they follow. Mm-hmm. And it's, even the villain has this, yeah, amazing heartline. And honestly, it's, you need to just see it for yourself.
Go see Black Panther. See, do yourself a favor.
Exactly. But it's so important that we're including into the conversation that, you know, I disliked the term like strong female lead for a while, because, mm-hmm, not all leads have to be strong.
True.
We want to see the nuance. Right. We want to see everyone, right, represented. And it's amazing that these things are finally coming into the conversation. And I am so excited to see what the next generation becomes, mm, because of, mm-hmm, the things that we're now able,
absolutely,
to get out there.
I mean, let's talk about having bald women,
yes,
in a movie. I mean,
my
that
word
in and of itself is, in all of the different natural hairstyles,
yeah,
Ryan Coogler talks about, and there's this great I think it's Vulture who did the breakdown,
yes,
of
this,
that one
the
scene, the fight scene in the casino.
So good.
We should post it.
Yes.
Because it's amazing watching him break it down. And
he
goes in and he's breaking down the clothing that they're wearing and how the colors are representing parts of the flag, the Pan-African flag. And he says in that clip, you know, it was very important for us to make all of these women have natural hairstyles. It was,
yes,
very important for us to do that. And, you know, for a long time, for African-American women to fit in, they had to literally damage their hair.
Yes.
With,
my gosh,
straighteners and,
yeah,
through other, you know, machinations.
Yes.
I don't even know enough about them to say what they are.
Right.
But for us to finally start seeing depictions of natural hairstyles,
yes,
it's not only representation for the communities themselves, it's for all of the other people.
Everyone,
because you
else
have to understand that, like, Black Panther going into like the middle of Alabama,
yes,
is going to be for some people like the first black
eye-opener
people they've ever seen,
right,
or like the first African American person with natural hair
with natural
that they've
hair
ever seen,
yes,
possibly, you know. And that is also part of representation. That's why it's so important.
It's huge.
There's a story that I like to tell. When I got to UNC Greensboro in North Carolina,
yeah,
I met someone who looked at me and said, you know, you're the first Jew I've ever met.
What?
This man was 18 years old and,
what,
I was the first Jew he'd ever met. And I said, well, I've got a lot to teach you, don't I? Representation in movies like this matter. And it's because they reach places where a lot of the time those people are not going out of their way to,
that's,
have those
such
experiences.
A good point.
And even there, it's not just that they're not going out of their way. They don't know what they don't know.
That's exactly it. I have heard so many stories and seen them. We've all seen the posts online about kids getting sent home from school, even for having quote unquote inappropriate hairstyles,
yeah,
which are just natural hairstyles.
Yeah.
And I think you're so right. It's because these people either haven't been exposed to them, have been ignorant of them, or really have just been without the means to educate themselves.
Yeah.
And so you're so right that putting them into this popular sphere where literally this movie is going to make more money than
it's
God
already
only knows.
It's already the fifth highest opening movie of all time,
all
behind
time
the Avengers.
Yep.
It's the highest February grossing movie of all time. It's made something like $300 million around the world.
Incredible.
In 3 days.
And worldwide too. Yeah. Like, you cannot make the argument that these kinds of movies don't sell overseas
the
anymore.
The soundtrack reached number one on iTunes before the movie came out. Mm-hmm. Before the movie. Before anyone had heard the soundtrack, it went to number one.
It's incredible. incredible. I'm just so excited that this is the age that we now live in, that we're getting to create these kinds of films, that people are seeing these kinds of films, and that those people who haven't had the means or haven't been exposed to them, sometimes through no fault of their own, just based around where they grew up. But now that we're able to bring this into the overall culture conversation and say, like, guys, educate yourselves. This is what's possible. This is what's here. We're all in this together.
Exactly. Representation matters.
It does.
It matters. And
it starts with us. It starts with, especially with those who have been given a certain amount of privilege. It doesn't negate anyone's circumstances. I'm not saying that. I'm
sure.
Know that people come from different backgrounds.
Absolutely.
And that's completely valid. But I recognize even that being born white affords me privileges that I would not have otherwise.
Absolutely.
We're in it together.
The shame of privilege does not come from being born into privilege.
No.
The shame of having privilege comes from knowing you have privilege and then not using it to help those who don't have privilege.
Yes. Oh, Malik, that's so well put.
And
so
that's
well
it. That's the end of it.
And so recognizing those things.
And asking
together.
And demanding representation.
Yes.
And really, demanding representation is as simple as giving money to things.
Yes.
Which is why we keep saying, go see Black Panther.
Yes.
Because
exactly.
If Black Panther becomes, you know, a 500, I mean, it's most likely going to become an over $1 billion movie.
Oh, I'm sure.
It changes the paradigm.
It does.
Like I said on the last podcast, every single movie with a female protagonist from now to the end of time will be compared to Wonder Woman.
Yes.
Every single one. And now every single movie that comes out that has an incomplete or inappropriate representation of a person of color is going to be compared to Black Panther and
Absolutely.
Say, they did it right.
Yes.
Why
you have
didn't
no
you?
Excuse. You have no excuse anymore. You have no excuse not to create fully rounded characters, not to include characters of, you know, of all walks, creeds, colors, what have you. And in our current climate, we can't afford not to talk about it and not to include it.
Amen.
In everything that we do.
Amen. Well, all right. I think that's a good note to end
on. I think that's a good place to end.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Kim, for being guest host today.
Max, thank you for having me. I hope that I did it justice.
Oh, please. I had so much fun having you
I
on.
I did too, as always.
We'll have to kick Allison off the podcast again at some point in the future.
Right. Allison, go make another feature movie.
Yes, please.
Amazing person.
Let's talk about that for one quick second.
Right?
Can we talk about the fact that over the last month and this last weekend, we have two members of our team making movies?
Like, what is going on? I am so in awe of these amazing ladies. Like, Jeanette and Allison, y'all are just killing
Shout
the game. I'm so proud of both of you.
Shout out.
And I can't wait to see both of them.
Amen.
My God, Banging Lainey and M Girls, y'all. Look out for them on the festival circuit eventually.
Yes. All right. Well, The Bitchery of History is brought to you by Ursula Major Productions. You can find us on Instagram at The Bitchery of History.
You can find us on Twitter at Bitchery Podcast.
You can find us on Facebook. Just search The Bitchery of History.
And we also have a website, umpboh.com.
On that website, there is a contact submission form. You can give us your comments. You can submit ladies for us to do in the future, examples for lady bits.
Yes.
You can just leave us a note.
We love hearing from you.
We love hearing from you. You know where else we love hearing from you?
Our Patreon.
On patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
You get little behind the scenes tidbits. There's a lot of outtakes, guys. We mess up pretty frequently. It's kind of hilarious.
There was one today.
There were several today, I think.
I think you said ear sight.
I think you did say ear sight. You'll have to find out on our Patreon, though.
Yeah. As always, a huge shout out to the team.
Shout out
we
to
could
the team.
Not do it without Jeanette,
Sydney,
Jess.
And, of course, Allison.
And, of course, you, Kim.
Max, we couldn't do any of this without you.
Oh, no,
I will never.
And, as always, bitches get stuff done.